If we look at over the last 3 years, if you look at Nielsen data, the highest growing streaming service across all these platforms other than YouTube is Tubi.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Friday, April 19th. Today, I'm joined by Julia Alexander to talk about the streamers. First, the growth of the free ad-supported streaming service Tubi and why it's blowing up with Gen Z, even as everyone else in the media is focused on subscription services like Netflix and Disney+. Julia also takes the temperature of Max, almost a year after the blue-chip television brand HBO was folded into the streaming service alongside a bunch of other Discovery content that isn't exactly as premium as Game of Thrones and Succession. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to The Powers That Be. Happy Coachella Friday, weekend two for those who celebrate. I'm going to make a couple assumptions about the people listening to this podcast. Please do not get offended, but I'm going to assume that you went to college. I'm going to assume you live in an urban core in this country. I'm going to assume that you pay for streaming services like Netflix, like Hulu, like Max. And I'm also going to assume, because of all of those things I just said, you probably don't watch Tubi. But Tubi, the News Corp-owned ad-supported free streaming network, is blowing up. I'm joined today by Julia Alexander to talk about that and much, much more. We're going to talk also about her take on the growing pains of HBO and Max and their merger. But first, Julia, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a while. Great to see you and hear you.
So good to see you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. You wrote this really smart piece a few weeks ago, and I wanted to have you on the podcast ever since then, about Tubi. So can you just explain what Tubi is and where it is in the landscape, and also why you wanted to write about this? Because it does seem like it's growing faster than other ad-supported streaming services, and I want to know why.
There are three different streaming lanes when we think about the streaming video premium entertainment landscape that we kind of exist in. There is SVOD, which is subscription video on demand. So that's your Netflix, your Max, your Disney+. Then there is AVOD, which is advertisement video on demand. Now, this used to imply that it was either free or it was substantially cheaper. We've moved away from that latter segment, and now it really is just much cheaper premium content. Again, as it pertains to the type of hour-long programming, half-hour comedy programming you might watch on your television, because AVOD also applies to YouTube. That's a whole other conversation. And then the third lane is called FAST, or free ad-supported television. And that is your Tubi, your Roku channel, your Pluto TV, which is owned by Paramount Global. And effectively what these services are is they take tons of old programming from all these other studios and networks. They throw it onto a service. So Tubi has about 240,000 hours of programming, which is much larger than a Netflix. But there's not very much new programming. There's very little to no sports. there's some local news, and really the best way to think of what these used to stand for was a way for cord cutters to go and say, okay, this is just going to do what I needed to do in the moment, and it's free. And now it is becoming a forefront of the streaming conversation.
So you mentioned that shows like Scandal are on Tubi. I want to hear more about what other pieces of content are on there. But you talk in your piece about how Tubi is really growing among audiences that aren't really served by other paid services. Black audiences are one, but in particular, you mentioned Gen Z, in part because of their behavior, which is the big screen is frequently the second screen. Like you're sitting on your couch, you're sitting on in your chair, you're scrolling on your phone, and then there's stuff on television that you kind of look up and watch. And to me, like this seems like the 2024 version of, like, obviously without phones, USA Network back in the day, or like Comedy Central just running reruns of South Park or something. Like, you just have it on in the background, you laugh, you chuckle, maybe you're enthralled, but like when the commercials come on, you just kind of look away and do something else. Is that an accurate take?
That's a pretty accurate take of Tubi, but to really understand why this service out of all the services, because there are many FAST platforms, especially in the United States, is taking off. If we look at over the last 3 years, if you look at Nielsen data, the highest growing streaming service across all these platforms other than YouTube is Tubi. And so Tubi is finding this audience. It is almost on par at this point with Disney Plus in terms of viewership share per month in the United States on connected television sets. It is above Max. It is, I believe at this point, above Peacock. So it's really sitting above these platforms that have a much larger cost structure associated with them. And so everybody wants to know why, right? Like, why is Tubi doing so well? And I think a big part of it is that the Tubi executives, and it's currently run by a woman who used to head up Vimeo, right? So she comes from this world of like very Silicon Valley, very online video structure. They understand that when we shifted into an attention economy, which is like a phrase people love to throw around, but when we really shifted into that economy, the fight for grabbing a slice of the pie no longer was a pie dominated by video entertainment. It was a pie dominated by things that you could do. So the immediate question went from being, when you're sitting on your couch, to, it went from what am I watching to what am I going to do? And that's a very difficult pie to carve out a piece for, right? So Netflix has spent over $100 billion since it's been in streaming trying to capture a piece of that pie. And Netflix, routinely, their executives say on earnings calls, we're competing with Fortnite, we're competing with YouTube, we're competing with TikTok, we're competing with sleep. This idea that the video component is not really a concern for us. So when you look at Tubi, there's a very strong understanding that there is a group of cord nevers, that is Gen Alpha, parts of Gen Z, that never subscribe to anything, who are very cost conscious of this for this reason, who don't necessarily place inherent value on the cost of their content, although they do place value on the ability to consume that content. And they're sitting on their couch and they're playing Fortnite, they're watching TikTok. That doesn't mean they don't want something else in the background. It doesn't mean they don't like television shows. And more importantly, what I've seen in my research over at Paired Analytics, where I work, is that a lot of these audiences want character-driven programming. They're less attracted to star-studded programming. And so what Tubi's done really well is said, great, we're free, so you don't have to worry about that value perception of when you're coming in. Like, we're going to give this to you, no problem. And also, we know you're going to want long-running shows like Scandal or Grey's Anatomy or whatever it might be, and we're going to provide that to you so you can just sit in and watch. And what this does, as you watch your TikTok on your phone or whatever it might be, is it trains you, when you're opening up your TV set, to go to Tubi first. And creating that habitual use case of opening an app every day is something that is so complicated and challenging to ingrain in a huge audience, that the more you can eat away at their decision to like, oh, I'm going to go to this app and not another app, means the more you can then extend their session time while they're sitting within it. And for Tubi, of course, the more you can charge advertisers for being on the platform.
Yeah, I mean, this is a different conversation, but there was a moment where on our Samsung television, you would turn it on. This is not Tubi, but I think Portlandia reruns were just on the IFC network every time we turned on our television for like a year. And Katie loves that show, and she would just like watch it and not change the channel. She was just grabbed by it. So I guess similar behavior there. One thing you do mention is, according to Parrot Analytics, where you also work, there's a 60% overlap of content across the major FAST platforms, including Tubi, with all the other big streaming video on demand services. So like, what kinds of character-driven shows are you talking about?
Yeah, it's the shows that you mentioned, right? It is like the USA Network type shows that we kind of didn't give a second thought to while they were airing. We were like, oh, Burn Notice, that seems like every other show. Or like House, right? Which was not an USA, it was a Fox show, I believe. But we were kind of like, yeah, okay, the show has been running for like 9 seasons. Like, who cares at this point? But those types of shows have gone away. Like, they've totally been gone because when Netflix came in, right, Netflix said, we really need people to adopt our streaming service. How are we going to do that? Their answer was Kevin Spacey, House of Cards, right? Like, their big answer was, let's do huge star-driven shows that are $100 million. It's this type of television that is in line with film. And we're going to really be this home. We're going to be HBO before HBO can become us, right? That's Ted Sarandos, who's the co-CEO of Netflix. That's his infamous quote from, like, 2013. And all these other streaming services followed. They said, okay, we're going to do prestige content. The average price of a TV show went up from $2, $3 million an episode to like $8, $9, $10, $11 million an episode. The big sci-fi ones, a big Marvel show, for example, might be sitting at $20, $25 million an episode. So the cost of the content you're creating has increased, and you don't want to necessarily be creating 100 shows every year. So you're creating, well, you're creating a significant amount of shows, but it's the same type of prestige. And at some point, this became oversaturated. At some point, audiences were like, I can get this type of HBO wannabe fanfare anywhere. What I can no longer get is Suits. I can no longer get Big Bang Theory. I can no longer get this type of show. And so those shows became readily available on a bunch of different platforms because the parent companies that own these streaming services, like Paramount Plus, Peacock, Disney Plus, Hulu, they realized that Wall Street really wanted to see profitability as opposed to pure subscriber growth. And so they switched their strategies around and they started licensing out all these back catalogs that they've had for decades. And so we can actually see the audience respond to it in the Nielsen figures, in the overall demand shares. We look at the total platform in where audiences are flocking to. And Tubi and Netflix, which received a lot of these old shows, have seen their usage increase every single month. And we've seen licensed programming, like for example on Netflix, makes up 45% of all viewing. Wow. That's phenomenal. So it's still this one of the strongest and most dominant forms of consumption on a platform like Netflix, which has invested heavily in original programming.
This is fascinating stuff. Julie, I want to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you your thoughts on how HBO is doing under the Max umbrella. Are you tired of sleeping hotter than hell? I sure am. I sleep hot. There's something crucial about sleep that eludes us when we're too warm, too uncomfortable, and too caught in the web of our own thoughts to drift off. And while curiosity fuels our days, science tells us that cool sleep recharges our nights. That's where ChiliPad by SleepMe comes in. Meet the bed cooling system that elevates the quality of human life through cool sleep. The ChiliPad bed cooling system is your new bedtime solution. I love it. It lets you customize your sleeping environment to your optimal temperature, ensuring you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. ChiliPad works with your existing mattress. It's a water-based mattress topper that continuously controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees, allowing your body to rest and recover. This isn't just about escaping the heat, it's also about optimizing your sleep for better health, more energy, and improved physical and cognitive performance, which I obviously need hosting a podcast. Chili pads are designed for one or two sleepers, so if your sleep partner likes to sleep at a different temperature, or you only need it for one side of the bed, that's okay too, and we know that's crucial. Plus, you can schedule automated temperature changes to trigger deep sleep. But when I'm at home, Chili Pad solves those problems. So trust me on this one. Visit sleep.me/powers to get your Chili Pad and save up to $315 with code POWERS. This offer is available exclusively for Powers That Be listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today with free shipping and try it out for 30 days. You can return it for free if you don't like it with their sleep trial. Visit www.sleep.me/powers because you're not just investing in better sleep, you're creating a better life.
Do you wake up in a cold sweat from your work dreams?
Have a coworker who keeps inviting you to do escape rooms?
Can't get a coworker to agree to do escape rooms?
Or are you just genuinely not sure how to take the next step in your career?
I'm Kate.
And I'm Kim. And together we run Amy Poehler's company, Paper Kite Productions.
We've been friends and colleagues for years, so we know how important it is to feel like someone has your back at work.
And we want to be that for you.
So we're hosting a weekly advice show where we answer all your work-related questions.
Something amazing happened. I got offered my dream job.
How am I supposed to bring this up to him without hurting his feelings? What should I do?
I want to like skip the pleasantries without being an asshole.
Careful, money and friends, they don't mix, babes.
They don't. And don't work with your friends, make your friends at work.
All right, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but that was actually $1 million advice.
Whether you need advice or just love to listen to other people's problems, this show is for you.
Listen and follow Million Dollar Advice, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to The Powers That Be, everybody. I'm talking to the brilliant Julia Alexander about streaming services. About 2 years ago, David Zaslav merged Discovery with Warner, creating Warner Brothers Discovery. As part of that, HBO got folded into the umbrella streaming service of Max. Julia, since then, I mean, I'm just talking anecdotally here. It seems like it's been okay. Sometimes it's hard to find things. You know, the UI over the last year or so since Max became Max has been a little clunky to me. How has HBO and HBO's content been performing under Max? Because they certainly had their hits. I mean, you had the Succession finale, you had The Last of Us, you had Euphoria, obviously Curb Your Enthusiasm just wrapped. I mean, HBO is still HBO, but I'm just curious now that it's not a standalone streamer, how it's performing as Max.
What you said sums the entire situation up perfectly.
Oh, well, thank
HBO
you.
HBO is still, we'll leave it at that. But how HBO is performing is how HBO has always performed. HBO continues to be HBO. Casey Bloys, who's the head of HBO, and his team continue to do what they're doing. The difference is the expectation of what HBO should be responsible for. And so if we look at the idea of what HBO was, it was a standalone network that was purchased on top of a cable plan. Mm-hmm. So you had your Comcast cable package. You said, I want to add HBO. It's $15. But HBO wasn't necessarily designed to be the only thing you watched. They understood that you're going to watch ESPN, you might watch Bravo, you might watch ABC. It was this collective ecosystem that HBO just happened to be a part of. When HBO effectively, in the way that we've been marketing it, became a streaming product, what the title HBO Max did was make it responsible for the success of this unified ecosystem and put it at the forefront of all subscriber activity, as opposed to just being a network that was responsible for its audience. It went from being responsible for ensuring that 25, 30 million people domestically were really happy with the product to 80 million, 85 million without changing its strategy. And that's really, really difficult. And so I think the greatest thing that happened to HBO was removing HBO from Max, because it no longer made HBO responsible for the success of that platform and in terms of marketing, in terms of brand perception. Instead, it made HBO a premium destination within a larger ecosystem once again. But I think HBO, not because of anything to do with itself, but because in the way that it has been repackaged over and over again, has lost a little bit of that shine to it, in part because it was almost meant to, because it was put on this pedestal as opposed to just being left alone as a destination for premium programming that found its own audience and stood out.
You wrote about all of this a couple weeks ago on Puck. Everyone go check it out. But how is Max doing overall?
It's pretty stagnant. It's hard to talk about Max's performance right now because it's in this really interesting transitional moment. Max is probably performing at 70%, 80% of what it's going to do in the United States. So if we use Netflix as the North Star with streaming in terms of subscriber acquisition, subscriber retention, at the time of we're recording this, Netflix is sitting about 80 million subscribers domestically. Mm-hmm. And so that is not a huge jump up from the 70 million that it was hovering at for quarters and quarters and quarters over the last few years. And the only way that Netflix has really increased that share is by cracking down on passwords. And so what we kind of know is that there's a saturation point for something like Netflix at about 90, 95 million subscribers. So if you're Max, let's assume your saturation point is probably about 75, 80 million subscribers domestically. The issue is how do you continue to grow that subscriber base without reducing your prices to increase the amount of people coming on, but also then losing out on your average revenue per user, right? ARPU, the term everyone loves in this industry, or without going international. Now we're really starting to see Max move into its international expansion, which they'll hopefully be able to find new subscribers and test out new pricing plans. But until that moment, it's remained in this position of, what is it exactly? It's a place that I go and watch HBO. It's a place that I go and watch Discovery programming, maybe. It's a place that I go to watch Harry Potter every 3 months whenever they have it. But beyond that, they haven't really been in the conversation. Their UI is not allowing for a strong experience, which in a direct-to-consumer market, whether it is an app or whether it is a website, is everything. And it doesn't really allow for this kind of contextual recommendation system, which is different from algorithmic. This is understanding that humans not necessarily want to watch a heavy show after they just watched a heavy show or movie. They want something light. They want, like human curators and programmers used to do on network television. And without any of that, Max is in a really difficult place to grow because people understand what it is. And so if they leave you, you almost have to spend twice as much to get them to come back because you have to reprove that value proposition. And the more that Max needs to do that, the more that their cost of acquiring a customer potentially goes up because you're reacquiring a customer and domestically, that puts it in a really dangerous position compared to some of its competitors.
That tracks so much with my experience using Max. Again, this is anecdotal. You're looking at this from a much larger data-driven picture. But I go there because I know HBO is there. Sometimes when we're looking for movies to watch, we go there and search the movie library. But it doesn't feel like there's a lot of human curation. They're not like heroing certain tiles at me. I guess they are sometimes. I just feel like I know what it's there for on the scroll at the bottom of my smart TV. Whereas, and I'm sure listeners can agree with this, you open up Netflix every single week and they're home running like a new show to you and really, really promoting the hell out of it. And you see that marketing elsewhere, like off platform too. So that's a good explainer of the difference. Thank you for illuminating that for me.
Yeah, the only thing I would say about streaming that is something I rant to Puck Editor-in-Chief John Kelly about, probably to his like annoyance. But the thing I often say to him is, if we consider how streaming that we think of it has worked over the last 5 years, it's been really hard to get a consistent data set to make any type of rational decision making based on. A lot of these streaming services launched either right before the pandemic or in the pandemic. And so it was a really strong moment for them because there was all these people signing up. They were doing really strong. Companies like Disney increased their projections for the amount of customers they were going to have onboarded. And when everything came crashing down, part of inflation, part of humans returning back to being human, it made it really difficult and they had to change their strategies again because the data sets changed. We've only just entered a period where you can actually make pretty strong projections or calculations based on the behavior, the consumer behavior that we can actually say is reliable. And trying to create another revolutionary moment within a streaming technology when these companies are not tech companies, when they are trying to figure out how to really change the focus of being a pure supplier to now being a distributor, being an operator, that means there's going to be a lot more hiccups along the way before we enter any kind of groove. And so all I'll say about Max or Peacock or Paramount Plus or any of them is that A few of them will fold over the coming years. It's just naturally going to happen. And the other ones that do survive are going to have these really twisty, turny near-term futures just because they're still trying to figure out what is happening on the linear side, what is happening with the internet and free apps like TikTok and YouTube and Snapchat. And they're trying to figure out what is happening with what they can control. But to think of them as competing only with each other and not with every single thing you could possibly do the minute you open your eyes and look at your phone is that's where it gets really concerning and daunting. And that is how we should be thinking about them. They're not just competing with each other. They are now competing with every conceivable thing you can do with a device. And that makes it much more complicated than any conversation about entertainment we've had 20 years ago.
Hopefully you're listening to the powers that be while watching season 7 of Curb Your Enthusiasm on Max. That would be the frontiers of doing everything with your device. Julia, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.